Session number 9173, reel 5.
Mr. Redaway, tape 5. Was there much reorganisation of the security forces?
Yes, certainly. And, of course, the rapid increase in the number of the forces available obviously had an impact on the whole setup there. The security side of the government became very much an entity in itself, answerable direct to the Field Marshal and to George Sinclair. The political side of the administration came into it in regard to assessment of intelligence, counter propaganda, psychological warfare, and that kind of thing. And then at the district level, of course, it made some difference. Local district security committees were formed with the district commissioner in the chair and then the local commander of forces of the army and the police superintendent. And they kept a close watch on the day-to-day developments in each district.
And what was your actual task, Mr. Redaway? What were you responsible for?
Well, I started as on the political side as Deputy Administrative Secretary. And my job there was to help in the assessment of intelligence and on the public information side, and also in time, I think the Field Marshal asked more and more for advice from me, I think primarily simply because of the long time I'd been there and the background I had and the context. I was also, of course, dealing with, to a large extent, with the civil administration, with the normal running of government under the administrative secretary. They'd introduced this post of administrative secretary and abolished the post of colonial secretary when George Sinclair was brought in as deputy governor. Previously, there had just been the governor and colonial secretary.
When were you made administrative secretary?
Sometime in 1956, the then administrative secretary was transferred to the West Indies, and I took over.
And what differences were there then, your task, when you became administrative secretary?
I became more and more involved in the task of trying to give the Field Marshal political advice, the exploration of possible courses of action, initiatives that we might undertake on the political plane. I'd really come more closely into touch with him at the time of the negotiations with Makarios, when it was my job to go along with him. I didn't attend the first one or two meetings, but I attended all the others, and my job was to go along and keep a note of what was said, and then go back to a government house with the field marshal at the end of the talks and prepare a report for London. It was they were long and deeply interesting talks, but also a bit of a strain. And my job was simply really to listen carefully and take a note for the record. But it was, I sometimes felt that the protagonists, the field marshal on the one side and Archbishop Macarius on the other, were both under a good deal of strain in the course of these discussions.
Yes, what was their style of negotiating? First of all, their two characters, were they very different?
Well, certainly very different men, of course. The Archbishop, a subtle, devious, I think it would be fair to say that, a man of great charm, and very, very quick in the uptake. Perhaps not, many people would not agree with this, but perhaps not a very wise man, politically skillful, or at least he became politically skillful and sophisticated, though he'd started, of course, with very little knowledge of the ordinary political affairs and the exercise of responsibility. That's something that people tend to forget about him, that having been brought up in a Greek Orthodox seminary in the monastery at Kiko and then in Greece and for a short period in a seminary in America, he had no experience whatsoever of the exercise of real political responsibility and not much grasp of political realities. Like so many people in the Enosis movement, he was obsessed with the justice of the case for Enosis and couldn't see much beyond that. He was, like nearly all Greek Cypriots, a skillful negotiator in the sense of driving a hard bargain. But again, like many of his compatriots, he didn't know when to stop, when he had got as much as he could possibly have got out of the other side, so he tended to press things much too far. He got on well with the field marshal, and naturally they were reserved towards one another, particularly at the beginning. But I think they both acquired a certain respect for one another, even some degree of liking, perhaps. The field marshal, on the other hand, of course, he's a very different sort of man. He'd exercised real responsibility at a very high level in the military field sphere in the past. Yes, and he acquired, really with amazing rapidity, a good grasp of what the Cyprus problem was all about, and showed, I thought, a very great skill in the process of the negotiation. Of course, he presented himself as a simple soldier. That was perhaps a strength in his position. I remember at one stage the field marshal had made what I thought was a very eloquent appeal. This was towards the end of the discussions. A very eloquent appeal to Archbishop Macarius to break the deadlock, to give his people a lead away from violence and back towards peace and negotiation. And I think it was obvious that the Archbishop was moved by this, but then after he'd reflected a bit, he stroked his beard and smiled his engaging smile and said, I understand, Sir John, but you have to realize that I cannot lead my people where they will not go. And I remember the field marshal turning to me at that point and saying under his breath, "Funny sort of leadership to my way of thinking." Yes. On the archbishop's side, of course, the Greek Cypriots are great bargainers,
yes,
and love driving a hard bargain. And this perhaps was where the archbishop failed. Sometimes, listening to the course of these negotiations, I couldn't but be reminded of disputes I'd had to try to settle in the villages over water or property or something of that kind. On his side, the field marshal would state clearly the position he'd been authorized to give to the archbishop, and I think rather expected the archbishop simply to say yes or no. Well, of course, it wasn't like that. The archbishop immediately would begin twisting and turning. Even when he'd gained a point, he would still try to, this was natural enough, he'd try to exploit it and say, "Well, that's fine, that goes some way to meet my point, but what about this or that?"
Did you find him at all hypocritical, the Archbishop?
Well, I'm rather cagey about using those sort of terms about other people. I suppose one, particularly the case of the Greek Cypriots. Certainly, I suppose, in public, you see, although he was then deeply implicated in the whole resort to violence and terrorism, but in public he was still saying that as a man of the church I deplore all forms of violence, and so I suppose one could accuse him of hypocrisy in that respect. But Greek Cypriots would, I'm sure, defend him and point to the fact that the office of ethnarchy was not merely that of archbishop, but also leader of the community. And so traditionally, as you know, in Greece, the church has played a political role quite different from that which the church plays elsewhere. Should have been which churches play elsewhere, but so I suppose it's clear.
Could I ask you about the topic of these negotiations? You have mentioned how the field marshal appealed to the archbishop to end the violence, but you know, were other issues involved in these negotiations? What was the purpose of them?
Well, the purpose of them, a good question, because at the time it seemed to me that the two sides were really talking about different issues, and that there wasn't much real contact between the motives or the ideas of the one side and the ideas of the other. The Archbishop, I think, he certainly looked on the negotiations as a procedure for getting control of affairs and the government of Cyprus in a relatively short space of time, and for using that to bring about the eventual union of Cyprus with Greece. And I got the impression that he probably genuinely believed that in their hearts the British government, British ministers and officials, accepted the case for Enesis, and that it was really a question of finding a way through the our difficulties with Turkey and with a conservative opinion in Britain, and to some extent saving face by a gradual but not a long drawn out approach to the culmination in Ennassis. The British, of course, were talking about something quite different. They were talking about the need to get Cyprus back onto the rails of peace and normal government, restoration of law and order. And they, on their side, I think, tended to take the line that the purpose was to provide the Archbishop with some face-saving formula which would allow him to call for a cessation of violence and cooperation in constitutional government without losing face as the protagonist of the Ennassis movement. So I think that basically there was a great chasm between the two sides there. Afterwards, a distinguished Philhellene and expert on Greece, Monty Woodhouse, said that the negotiations seemed to him to have broken up, broken down, just or to have been broken down, implying the British caused the breakdown, just at the point where they were getting onto the real substance of the problem and with some possibility of making progress. That, I would myself have said, was a great, an almost complete misunderstanding of what was going on. In the end, as you know, the negotiations broke down over three issues. There was the question of amnesty for convicted terrorists, and there some compromise might have been possible. The British were insisting that people who'd been convicted of crimes of violence would have to stay in prison, but that others would be amnestied. There was room for negotiation there. And then the nature of the form of self-government which was proposed. We'd got to the state. The Archbishop, of course, was insisting on virtually complete control from the from the beginning, and the British, and that meant, of course, a dominating Greek Cypriot voice in the legislature and the executive. The British had got to the point of assuring him that the composition of the legislature and the executive would reflect normal democratic practice. I think there's some phrase such as that, which certainly implies majority Greek Cypriot rule. But then we went on to say we couldn't have a settle with him in private the form of government for Cyprus as a whole, because we needed to consult other parties, and it would have to be worked out in cooperation with everyone concerned, meaning primarily, of course, the Turkish Cypriots. There again, I suppose, there might have been scope for further discussion, though we had really probably come near to the end of the road as far as any concessions we could make to the Archbishop on that were concerned. But the real cause of the breakdown, to my mind, was the Archbishop's insistence on control of internal security. He insisted that within a short space of time, within a year, I think it was, the governor should relinquish control, the British governor should relinquish control of internal security and hand it over to the chief a Cypriot minister, might be himself or some nominee of his. Now that, I think, convinced the British that what the Archbishop was after was simply to secure control of the island and then achieve his ambition of Enesis. We were not prepared for that, and so that was the issue on which the negotiations broke down. And indeed, of course, it really was pretty absurd in the circumstances which then existed with the terrorism that was going on, with the intensification of hostilities between Greeks and Turks, which had already begun. It was really going much too far to suggest that there could be a transfer of responsibility for internal security within the immediate future.
You did mention earlier on that you attended these negotiations with Makarios and Harding.
Yes.
What was your role during these negotiations? What had you to do?
Well, as I've said, it really was to sit by the field marshal, to listen in to what was being said in Greek as well as in English, because, of course, the archbishops spoke in Greek all the time, and the field marshal in English, and then it was translated, but not always completely translated, so it was of some assistance anyway that I should be there and be able to follow everything that was said.
Did you actually advise the field marshal on the spot?
Oh yes, it was part of my job, if something occurred to me, to jot a little note down and put it under his eyes. Sometimes he used it, and sometimes he didn't. And then, as I've told you, to make a record, and afterwards to do a report to London, which was often a long time. The meetings used to go on quite late, to about 11 o'clock at night, and then it meant drafting a long telegram to London, which might take 3 hours or something like that. So they were quite exhausting encounters. also, they were held on neutral ground, that is to say, on the Anglican Archdeacon's house, he had some of the most uncomfortable chairs I've ever sat on around his dining table, where we used to sit for 2 or 3 hours at a time.
Did you have any role in setting up these negotiations in the first place?
No. No, I wasn't in on the, I think I mentioned, on the first two meetings, something like that. So I came in really in the middle, when they'd already got a fair way. As for the setting them up, it was really, as it developed, it was a question of taking the negotiations to a certain stage, and then each side would have made its position clear up to then, and then they would agree to meet at some date, having had the opportunity of giving further thought and clarifying their positions and taking it on from where they left off. So there wasn't really much in the way of a formal agenda. So I suppose, yes, at the beginning of each meeting, the two Makarios and Harding would decide that these were the topics to be discussed, but in fact the topics nominated themselves.
Were there other advisers there besides yourself?
Not on the British side. There was a Greek Cypriot officer from the information department who did the interpretation, and then on the Greek side, the Archbishop had the secretary to the Ethnarchy, Mr. Kranidiotis, and his own personal secretary with him, and that was about the limit of it. I think they didn't want to have too many people in on these talks, they were conducted very much, of course, by the two, so to speak, heads of delegation. It was a direct personal confrontation between the Archbishop and the Field Marshal.
And there were no other negotiations?
Hardly any. Towards the end, when the British under pressure from Makarios had specified as far as they felt they could the form of the internal self-government which was on offer. He'd asked for further details on some of the points, and these were put back to London, and then I was deputed to go and see Cranidiotis. I think we may have had one or two meetings, and it simply went over the ground. But it was not a negotiation. That was just an exchange of information.
Was any other British politician involved? Was any British politician involved?
I imagine you're asking me about Francis Noel Baker. Yes, as you know, the Noel Baker family have long connections with Greece, and I suppose Francis Noel Baker volunteered his services at this stage. That was when the negotiations were getting towards the end, and I'm told, I don't know, that both Anthony Eden and Lennox Boyd, the colonial secretary, were consulted, and they both thought that it would probably be a good idea for Noel Baker to come out to Cyprus and see if he could help. And indeed, with his excellent Greek and his Philhellene background, I think he already was acquainted with the Archbishop. It did seem as though he might indeed be able to play a useful role, a sort of deus ex machina. It didn't quite turn out that way. He came and informed himself of the position, and then went away to talk to the Archbishop, came back again and said, these are the points which he's emphasising now. Can you, if only you can yield a little on these, perhaps we may have a settlement in prospect. So Harding went back to the government in London and got these points clarified as far as the British were willing to go at that stage. And I think the points had really narrowed themselves down to three at that stage. I can't remember precisely what they were. But they were mainly concerned with the degree of self-government that was in prospect. Noel Baker went to the Archbishop and said, it's all right, your beatitude. This is the impression I got of what had happened. He said, it's all right, your beatitude. I squared the British. They're agreeable to A, B, and C. And predictably, the Archbishop's reaction was, well, that's fine, Mr. Noel Baker. I'm delighted to hear that. But now what about D, E, and F? And so then Noel Baker came back, and by that time, I think on the British side, people were beginning to get pretty irritated.